I'm David Crow. Thank you for tuning in to episode 167 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. Email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crow with an E. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Listen every Tuesday at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time on PRN.FM or download the MP3 after broadcast on iTunes or other podcast apps. Kind of overdid the interview this week, so we'll get right to it. Andy Rees and Ollie Richards have worked on the film Endgame about assisted dying, also known as euthanasia or assisted suicide, a very controversial topic that the film doesn't shy away from. Welcome to the show, Andy and Ollie. First, wondering why you made a film about people ending their lives because they feel that the illness they have is too painful or their life is hopeless. Why did you make a documentary on this subject?
Well, David, in the UK, there are two legal challenges going on at the moment. And there's a subtle difference between the two of them. One is a gentleman who has motor neuron disease and has been deemed terminally ill, and another gentleman who has multiple system atrophy, which is arguably a worse condition, but his situation means that he's deemed only incurably ill. And about 18 months ago, Ollie and I were just, you know, following these news stories, and from a legal perspective, it became quite interesting, and we read up on them. And then we were looking at the history of this, and, you know, globally, the situation where the UK stands in respect of other people's other countries' laws, and we just became intrigued, and so we started off by getting in contact with a couple of people who had connections with these two legal challenges, and from there, kind of fortuitously and completely unexpectedly, we were introduced to four different characters, all who have very different situations and challenges to deal with. And at that point, because we didn't know where their stories were going to go, it was simply a matter of just sort of following them along a winding road and seeing where it would end up. So in answer to your question, it was the legal curiosity and complexity of the High Court challenges that got our initial interest. But then it was understanding that these four people and many, many others are just dealing with situations which are unimaginable to anyone who is not suffering from it. And the stories had to be told.
Yes. I mean, one of the people you document quite extensively in the film is Omed, who as you said, is suffering from multiple system atrophy. And if I had just seen Omed, you can see visibly that he is very ill and he's in pain, that he's immobilized, that there's really no hope that he's ever going to get better. And I have no trouble sympathizing with somebody like that. More difficult cases were the people who didn't appear to be ill on the surface. And you kind of wonder, why are they trying to end their lives? But you can't show, there's no way to show whether people are suffering pain like they say they are or not.
I think there probably is a way to prove and show that people are suffering. Whether a viewer or an audience can appreciate that extent, I'm not sure is really the issue. It's are we going to allow people to have that choice? And the complexity and the challenge at that point is when a country or a government does indeed change a law to allow people to have that choice, the question then begs, how far does that door open?
I wasn't saying that I didn't believe these people, but it's you know, I just found it harder to be sympathetic when you couldn't see their pain or their disability. Like, for example, the woman Carmen, who's kind of the bookend of this thing, she's talking about assisted suicide at the beginning, and she does it at the end, which is quite, Marie, which is quite moving. But you know, she was very lucid when she was talking. She talked without any indication of a disability. If the average person saw her on television, they'd say, "Why is she doing this?" Clearly, she's normal, right? She's lucid. She's carrying on a normal conversation. She's passionate about certain things, and yet she wants to kill herself.
Well, I know absolutely, and that actually, ironically, is I think one of the reasons why the film is poignant, because Marie's condition is that she had a very chronic and rare form of Crohn's disease, which is essentially an intestinal disease, and she'd had that since the age of 13, and between the age of 20 and the age of 54, which was how old when she died, she'd had 39 essentially major operations.
Mm-hmm.
When you equate that to sort of one major operation every sort of 8 or 9 months, and you realize that it's not going to get better, it is incurable. She's absolutely exhausted by this. She has to go to the she has to go to the toilet 30 times a day.
Right.
She has no quality of life. At that point, I think one has to ask, what right does anyone else have to judge whether she looks ill or not?
Yes.
And therefore, should she be allowed to go to Switzerland or not?
Well, and I mean, the fact is, she is allowed to go to Switzerland, and it would be, I don't know how you would stop somebody who is thinking of ending their life from going to Switzerland. You know, how would you do that? Say that people who have pain can't travel? How would you know that somebody is going to Switzerland to end their life and not going to see the Edelweiss?
It is a very good point. I mean, in terms of how would the clinics in Switzerland, they're not actually called clinics, they're called organizations. How do the organizations vet clients or patients? That's one question, which is relevant to what you've just said. But the alternative, David, and I'll bring something else in, which is quite interesting. There was a case, and I forget his name, but he was a young guy in Canada. I think it was actually Calgary, who had manic depression, and he had it for many, many, many years. And he had tried and had thought about this, et cetera, et cetera, had built up a very big following within the sort of Right to Die campaign groups. Mm. And very sadly, last year, ended up committing suicide on his own, and devastating his family, his girlfriend, et cetera, et cetera. I think the question all over the world that needs to be asked is, do we have a right to judge other people? Do we have a right to change the law and then simply allow the law to become as flexible as it might be in some places like Belgium or the Netherlands?
Right. I mean, in Canada, we have assisted dying legislation, but it's still kind of controversial. It has been used a relatively small number of times, like a few hundred. It's not like, you know, thousands of people are out there killing themselves. So some of the fears of the people who said this was going to lead to, you know, getting rid of all the inconvenient old people and stuff don't seem to be realized. But there are still a lot of things that aren't allowed, and some of them are assisted dying in children, and nobody can deny that some children are suffering immensely and are going to eventually die. And then you brought up the issue of mental illness, which is very difficult, because one of the symptoms of so-called depression is that people want to kill themselves. And so do we say that's not a symptom, that's a rational desire? And then there are, as you've brought out quite well in the film, there are the non-terminal cases, people who are suffering but aren't in any danger of dying anytime soon, that we could keep them alive potentially for years, in their condition of suffering. And I think Omed was a really good example in your film of this kind of situation.
But hopefully, David, the film, with exactly what you've said in mind, hopefully the film will ask more questions than lead to answers. That this film is in no way meant to be a campaign film for assisted suicide.
No, I mean, it really made me, I would say that was one of the best things about watching it, is it really made me think about this, because at times I would really sympathize with the person, like, you know, although with Maria, I couldn't really see her pain, she talked about it, and, you know, just the fact she talked, as you said, about so many operations and things like that, I eventually sympathized with her. Omed was really easy, because you can just see his pain. There was the case of another guy, Tony, with locked-in syndrome, and just looking at his shrunken body and his almost complete inability to move, you certainly can sympathize with that. Other people I had a lot more difficulty with, like Alex, who said he had early-onset Alzheimer's, who seemed to be totally lucid in his conversations with you, and I wondered if he was just looking for attention, just like somebody who would threaten suicide, saying, I'm going to kill myself because nobody loves me. It seemed to me I wasn't convinced that he was looking for this for the best reasons, but who am I to say?
I think Ollie and I would not disagree with you with those comments. And of course, you and anyone else are entitled to their opinions. Alex's dilemma, as we were filming him over the last sort of 8 or 9 months, Alex wasn't suicidal.
Mm-hmm.
But having looked after and witnessed his father's demise with dementia, which he describes as a pathetic and undignified end, his dilemma was the timing of it. Mm-hmm. And the reason we chose to include Alex in this is, in the UK, dementia, I'm just going to sort of wrap off some facts verbatim here, but in the UK, dementia is the leading cause of death. And so more and more people are going to be in that situation.
Yes.
Many, many people, I think most of us would say that we wouldn't want to be a burden on society and or our families if we were in that situation. And therefore, with assisted suicide or assisted dying, one has to be of mental capacity and of mental competence. So whilst he wasn't suicidal, he can foresee the future, and he needs to make that decision for himself. And arguably, he will be going to Switzerland too early. I don't want to ramble on too much, but that predicament, I think, is one of the most poignant in the film. It could have been made stronger, but we weren't allowed to film his girlfriend and family, who were utterly distraught with this idea.
Right, right.
And so his predicament is really difficult. But again, you know, if I found myself 2 years into an Alzheimer's diagnosis with arguably a prognosis of 7 years to live, and most psychiatrists would say that you begin to lose your marbles within four and a half years, you're going to be thinking about that window of opportunity.
What's the role of the medical system in producing these conditions? Like, I'm very suspicious about Crohn's disease, because there are so many pharmaceutical drugs that can damage the intestinal system, vaccines and drugs.
Yep.
And that didn't really enter into the film, but I was wondering, you know, I'm that's it's in a sense it's irrelevant, because these people aren't going to, you know, have their intestines brought back again, you know, 40 years after they first started suffering from this. But on the other hand, every year the medical system is injuring more and more people, and it seemed a bit hypocritical to me that you're saying in the United Kingdom, the medical establishment is opposed to assisted dying. They say they don't want to bring death, and yet They do every year. Like in the US, it's been estimated that 106,000 people, like in 1998, 106,000 people were estimated to die from properly prescribed pharmaceutical drugs. And probably a million are injured by those drugs. And some of those people are going to suffer. And the medical establishment is saying, well, you have to suffer until you die because we're not going to help you.
Well, if you want to bring that relevance specifically to Marie within the film, she'd had 80% of her intestines removed. None of the drugs that she'd been prescribed, according to her, were going to work. The only thing that was working was the most incredible heavy dosage of morphine, every day, and that was simply killing pain. It wasn't.
Right, like morphine's not a cure for anything.
No.
It's like pain is not the bottom, is not the illness, right? You can mask the symptoms. So clearly, I think in a case like that, obviously if mistakes were made, you can't go back and undo them. But it seems to me that our medical system, with its heavy on interventions, heavy on pharmaceutical drugs and vaccines, is
Yeah.
causing a lot of suffering. Why does the medical establishment in the United Kingdom say that they oppose assisted dying?
The knee-jerk straight answer to that is because the UK government is beholden to the Church of England. And the High Court in the UK, since the Tony Nicholson case, the historical case that we feature in the film, the High Court have been sympathetic, but they can really only take it to Parliament. And as they did with Tony Nicholson, and as they will do with the two current High Court challenges, is they will simply say Parliament has to debate it, Parliament has to introduce the bill. And the bottom line is Parliament won't. They won't debate it, they won't introduce a bill because they are so influenced by the church.
And is assisted dying in the United Kingdom completely illegal?
Yes, it's illegal, yes.
Right. So even the most severe case cannot legally get assistance with suicide.
Not legally, no. Assisted suicide in the UK is illegal. Assisted suicide in Switzerland is not legal. It is simply decriminalized. Assisted suicide is only legal in Belgium, Denmark, the Netherlands, and in the states in Oregon, California, Washington, D.C., and Colorado.
And Canada.
And most recently Canada,
Yes.
and also Colombia.
I mean, it seems a little bit like the approach that Ireland takes to abortion. It's almost completely banned in
It's
Ireland.
very similar, David, yeah.
Right. But anybody with money and the ability to travel can go to the United Kingdom or somewhere else to get an abortion, and there's really not much that the Irish can do about it. So the pressure is probably a lot less than if they were able to completely ban it. Here, of course, it's the same situation, but it's worse because there are many people who are sick who can't travel because of their illness. So while Marie was able to travel to Switzerland, and I don't think I'm really giving away the end of the
No.
film to say that she completed her journey. Omed, who's restricted to a bed, and also Tony,
Yes.
both restricted to bed,
Yes.
were unable to go to Switzerland either because they couldn't travel or they could not actually actuate the infusion of chemicals that would kill them.
Correct.
And also the not only is assisted suicide illegal, but helping someone to attempt is also illegal.
So
So
arguably, Ollie's made a good point here. So arguably, if Omid's wife was to push him up the EasyJet ramp, she could, it's unlikely, but she could, upon her return, be arrested and charged with aiding and abetting a suicide.
I don't know if it's that unlikely. I mean, I can't think of any situations right now, but governments can be incredibly harsh. Like we had a case in Canada probably 20 years ago now where a man, a couple had a child who was suffering, I don't know, cystic fibrosis or something like that, and her quality of life was horrible. And the father took her to the garage and killed her with carbon monoxide exhaust from his vehicle. And he was charged with first-degree murder and convicted. Everybody said, you know, despite the fact that this was, you know, obviously a simple legal case, it was legally, it was clearly first-degree murder. Many people sympathized with him, but there was nothing that anybody could do. And even today, I don't think there's anything that could be done. But most people felt that he did it because he loved his child, not because she was a burden on him. But well, the government pursued and sent him to jail for, I don't know, 20 years or something. They had a minimum sentence for first degree murder, which he got.
Yeah, I think we early in our filming, we had a we did an interview interview with a man who.
Alan,
who unfortunately their interview didn't make the final edit. But he went to Switzerland with his partner to because his partner was suffering from terminal cancer. And the procedure went ahead. And upon his return, there were police waiting for him at the airport. And he was taken in. Interviewed, obviously no charges were filed and he was released. But yeah, it has happened that
like I noticed that in Switzerland it is the person who's going to die who actuates the infusion, right? So the act of dying is initiated by the person who wants to die, not by a caregiver and not by a doctor or nurse, which I presume is for legal reasons, because it would be easy for somebody else to press the button.
Yeah, it's a little bit more complicated than that, and I can just briefly explain it. The reason why traveling to Switzerland has become a byword, and the reason why suicide tourism in Switzerland is such a popular phrase is because whilst Switzerland hasn't legalized assisted suicide, it's decriminalized. And by virtue of that, the Swiss, being the Swiss, are the only country that allow foreign nationals to take advantage of their decriminalized laws.
Right.
So that's the first reason why Switzerland is the only country that you and or I, well, you could do it at home now, but Ollie and I could go to currently in the UK. But there's a sort of caveat to this in the sense that there are five main organizations in Switzerland. And most people will have heard of Dignitas, which is based in Zurich.
Mm-hmm.
The organization we chose was an organization called Life Circle. And there's a difference between the four others and Life Circle in that Life Circle is owned and run by a medical doctor. Mm-hmm. And by virtue of that, She is allowed to prescribe the fatal barbiturate either orally or by intravenous. All the others, including Dignitas, are not administered by medical professionals. And by virtue of that, they cannot prescribe it any other way than orally.
Right.
And that's quite... And that's quite an interesting fact about Life Circle, because the actual process of digesting it orally is not so much fun. Whereas at Life Circle, the process, as you see in the film with Marie, it is really quite serene and peaceful, and nothing more than a fatal general anesthetic.
Yes, yes. I mean, it did. I think that's one thing that came across very well in the film was how calm and peaceful it was for her at the end, which is probably a concern for a lot of people. You wouldn't want to think that somebody was trying to end their life and then ended up with, you know, like the death penalty in the United States. Yeah. I mean, this is interesting. It's not something I thought of, but it's very difficult to administer the death penalty in the United States, even though it's, you know, in technology-wise, it's not that different from, you know, assisted dying. And yet they seem to have these horrible situations where people are writhing for some period of time.
Well, David, after Ollie and I had left Marie on that morning, we sat in a pub in Basel, and we really couldn't. We didn't have much conversation because we were both a bit numb and stunned by the surrealism. But when we were able to talk, one of the conversations was, "Well, hang on a second. If it's that simple and it's that quick and it's that serene and it appears to be that painless, why is this particular barbiturate, which is actually costing dollars?
Yes.
I mean, it's not expensive. Why are, you know, the states that do have the death penalty by lethal injection not going with this? Why do they need to have this concoction of four different injections, which people have seen?"
Well, I think the reason is because there's a lot of drug companies will not sell drugs to them anymore. So they have gone with whatever drugs that they can get. And I think another factor is that many of the people that they're killing, ironically, are seriously ill. Many of them were severe drug addicts. And so they don't have the veins that are needed for problem-free injection. I mean, one guy recently, they had to stop the execution because they couldn't find a vein. So presumably they're going to try to fatten him up a little bit, get him healthier so they can kill him.
I mean, finding a vein is one thing. But, you know, and whether you can or whether you can't, and if you fatten them up, then, you know, that's one issue. But if you can find a vein, why do you need to have the process of four different intravenous with four different stages when this fatal barbiturate, you know, essentially put Marie into a coma within seconds, and
yes,
she was dead within 3 or 4 minutes?
Yeah, I don't know. I definitely don't know enough about the drugs that are being used, but it seems like a remarkable contrast between the executions that are so full of problems and appear sometimes agonizing for the person who's being killed versus what we saw with Marie.
Yeah.
Another factor in a couple of these cases, both with Marie and a man with multiple sclerosis, Colin, I think, was the lack of social services. And I wondered, Colin, I believe, was the man who changed his mind about committing suicide. Marie also commented about how difficult it was for her to get social services, which may be somewhat of a reflection of the years of either the conservative governments in England or the Labour government, which had lost all of its socialist instincts over the years with, like, Tony Blair. So that social services have been ravaged in the UK, and for somebody who's seriously ill to get, say, a ground floor apartment or something so that they can access it, that seemed impossible, which was tragic.
You interestingly mentioned Alex and thought that he might be seeking attention. I think both Ollie and I would agree that if there was anyone seeking attention within the film, and this is not to take anything away from Colin's severe and progressive multiple sclerosis, I think he was the one who was seeking attention. He was the one entertaining the press. And I think he was trying to do that because the guy couldn't walk upstairs very well. He was living in a first floor flat, and he was saying that social services couldn't help him. Going back to your question about the politics of this, the interesting thing about both Colin and Marie's situation politically is social services cut their benefits in 2011 after the Conservative Liberal coalition, David Cameron and Nick Clegg, which just happens to be, ironically, the very same year that the Conservative government whacked an additional £6,000 onto students' annual tuition fees.
Yes, and where did all that money go?
Well,
I mean, I guess it's out of scope for this conversation, but...
It's out of scope for this conversation and off the record, but it's probably to be found in David Cameron's offshore account in the Cayman Islands.
Yes, well, there could be that. Yeah. I was glad to see the back of David Cameron after he just wrecked England. What a smarmy, rich boy that guy was. You know, he seemed to have no concern. Just thought life was a joke because he'd never actually had to struggle in his life. And there are these people are clearly struggling.
Well, no, precisely, exactly, and I think there lies the issue. And again, we couldn't put this in the film because it would have just complicated the issue and convoluted the matter. But in terms of Marie's story, Marie was a city banker in London, and she lived outside London in a place called Aylesbury in Buckinghamshire, which is the county next to Oxfordshire, which is where Ollie and I are currently. And her local MP, to whom she wrote on countless occasions, just happens to be a guy called John Burko, who is the Speaker of the House of Commons. And on the morning of Marie's passing, she gave me like a ream of paperwork and letters that she'd had from social services, from Aylesbury County Council, et cetera, doctors and blah, blah. And there was a letter from John Burko's office, which is in 2012, which essentially said, yeah, sorry about this, but there's not an awful lot we can do. You're simply a number on, you know, an Excel spreadsheet. We'll get round to it when we can. And I think I think at that point, politically, Marie said, well, hang on a second. I've been a 40% taxpayer for the last 10 years in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
And you are now cutting all of my benefits. I can't work anymore. I'm having to pay for the necessary treatment I'm going to have, which is going to arguably cost well over £1,000 a month.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking between £12,000 and £15,000 a year for the next however many years. And her very pragmatic question was, well, hang on a second. It's costing me all this money. I'm going to have to sell my house. I'm absolutely knackered because I've had 39 operations in as many years, if mm-hmm. not more. Why? I'm just going to go to Switzerland, pay £10,000 and be done with this. Mm-hmm. And at that point, for me only, I do understand what you were saying about the idea that you can't, you know, necessarily, you know, visibly see Marie's pain and suffering. When you hear that, at that point, she does kind of have a right to do that.
Yeah, no, I don't think that. I think in her case, she was angry about the social services, but I think if they had given her more social services, it wouldn't have changed the fact that her intestines were essentially gone.
No.
I think so.
It
wouldn't have changed it. But with Colin, it appeared, I mean, he did eventually get a ground floor flat or something, and that meant that he could get around a lot more easily. He wasn't housebound all the time. But I think also, I think you said...
Sorry to interject. Now we're in the middle of a winter that Colin absolutely feared with dread. Only this afternoon, Colin posted on Facebook him playing the guitar at his new housing association Christmas lunch.
And I think
it's really important, David, within the film, that we do have someone who has changed their mind and they are still living, and they appear to be having a quality of life, despite the difficulties of what he is challenged with, but is going through it.
Right, and did you say in the film that it was his girlfriend or something who kind of persuaded him to change his mind? Like, how did it come about?
It wasn't a girlfriend. It was Colin. Colin, by virtue of the fact that he wanted the PR and he wanted to get new accommodation, was very vocal with the media. And the media, of course, were looking for stories. And so he was all over the press in Scotland and all over the local television. And on his last broadcast, before he was meant to go to Switzerland in June, the night that was shown, a woman from the Highlands, very close to where he comes from, called Rona, got in touch with the TV station and said, look, you know, I think I've got a worse condition of multiple sclerosis than you. I'm going to go and try stem cell treatment. Don't do it. And it was that reach out from Rona that persuaded Colin not to go to Switzerland.
Okay. I had misinterpreted the connection between those two people. But I mean, another thing you've briefly talked about is the impact on the family. I mean, this is the interesting thing about this documentary. I would sympathize with one side or the other. When you think about the family, like in the case of Alex, who's freaking out about the Alzheimer's that may or may not get worse over time, and who knows? I'm not even convinced that there is a single syndrome called Alzheimer's, so I don't know how doctors really predict with any accuracy how long it will progress.
Is a good point. Yeah.
I mean, it's a set of symptoms, right? There's nobody saying we know that Alzheimer's is caused by this gene, this virus, this chemical, whatever, right? There may be multiple reasons, and if there's multiple reasons, there would be multiple rates of progression. And if you don't know what the reason is, that would mean you couldn't predict. But I can imagine that a family in a situation like that would say, you know, okay, you're not like you used to be, you know, you're a little forgetful, but that happens as you get older, but we don't want you to kill yourself. We love you and we want you around and we don't believe that you need to do this. It must be devastating for a family, as opposed to other cases, like in the case of Tony with the locked-in syndrome, where his family, I think, supported his desire to end his life because they saw, again, they saw that he was in tremendous pain and disability.
Yeah, which is the reason we chose not to get too much involved in the family drama of this, because that would essentially take away from the legal focus of these people and indeed their personal choices. In answer to your question, it comes back at that point to how much do you respect that person? Because Alex, whose girlfriend, as I mentioned, is distraught and beside herself with the idea of Alex going, she's told him that she is more than happy to look after him until he's at a point where he's dribbling like a baby and his ass is running 24 hours a day. Because she loves him. But, you know, but then naturally, Alex is saying, well, love, I don't want that.
Mm-hmm.
At which point, when does the family have to concede and capitulate to the idea that they have to appreciate what that person wants?
Well, I think, you know, he did have other family members who did support him. And so it does differ. You know, we interviewed friends and a couple of other family of Alex who did support. It was his girlfriend that was very adamant she wanted to look after him to the end. But I think obviously no one wants people to die, but it's that acceptance of that, do they, yes, like Andy said, do they respect the wishes of that person and how are they willing to cooperate with that?
And here lies another interesting, very current, I mean, literally this week situation is you probably know this, David, but in the UK and all over the world, you can have what's called an advanced decision, whereby there's a piece of paper that says if you have lost your mental capacity, etc., or if you are in a car crash and in a coma that you're not going to get out of, then if you've signed that, doctors have to respect the wishes of it and take the appropriate action. However, only this week in the UK was a story of a woman who had been in a coma and had been kept alive against her will because she'd had an advanced decision, and the family sued the NHS and they won £45,000 worth of legal costs because the NHS eventually had to admit that they had actually kept this woman alive for 2 years and ignored her advanced decision.
So this was not even assisted suicide. This is a woman basically do not resuscitate or, you know, do not take heroic methods, which they're supposed to respect. So you're not allowed to kill yourself, but you're allowed to stop yourself from living if interventions are necessary to continue to live.
Yes.
And they won't even do that.
Well, I mean, I was speaking to a paramedic about this the other day because we're making a short film with him, and I mentioned this to him, and he said, look, it doesn't matter. If you've got your advanced decision tattooed on your wrist or stuck on the fridge, and you collapse in the kitchen and we arrive, we are essentially going to ignore that.
They're always going to ignore it.
Yeah.
So if paramedics come, they're going to resuscitate you whether or not you have an order.
Yes.
There are conundrums. I mean, let's say that you have a do not resuscitate order because you have, you know, you're worried about dying of something, and then you choke on some food.
Yes.
And that's clearly not what you were anticipating. So how could you not save somebody's life? You know, give them the Heimlich maneuver or remove the food from their mouth or something. They were thinking about something more serious than that, or, you know, something less easily resolved, some chronic condition.
But that's a perfectly logical argument that you've just made that the paramedics would uphold. You know, our job is not to, you know, sit down and discuss the situation there and then. Our job is to get that person into hospital and get them better.
Yes, I can sympathize with that because, you know, if you really are terminally ill, when they get you to the hospital, the situation is going to arise in a place where it's going to be much easier to decide what to do and to do the right thing. I'm not sure you can blame a paramedic who
of course you can't.
Has to make, I mean, I don't know what I would do in a situation where, okay, a piece of paper says do not resuscitate, but, you know, something unexpected has happened and it's really easy for us to fix it.
And that's the reason why the whole thing becomes complicated. And again, we had a guy from a charity in the UK, pro-assisted suicide, saying everyone must have an advanced decision because it's only a matter of time until the NHS and the law, you know, has to adhere to it. But that will never happen because of all of the examples that you've just cited.
Yes. Another thing you mentioned earlier that we didn't really get too far into that kind of surprised me was the influence of the church, because I don't think of the United Kingdom as a very religious institution, as a very religious country, and I'm sure, you know, most people aren't adamant, enthusiastic churchgoers or mosque or synagogue or whatever. But England, and this might surprise some people, does have an official religion. Right, the as far as I know, the Queen has to be an Anglican. She has to belong to the Church of England. It's not possible to have somebody from any other sect of Christianity, let alone a non-Christian, as the monarch.
It's the reason why Merkel has to be confirmed.
Right, because she has to be Church of England, or she can't marry the prince. So that everybody within the royal family has to be of a single religion. So, I mean, I thought that was just kind of window dressing, but you're saying it has real impacts where the government can't contradict the Church of England too badly or bad things will happen.
The government cannot and will not. I mean, if you look at public opinion polls, then you'll find that probably 80% of the population would disagree with that and don't go to church. And if you were to do random, you know, polls on the street, a knee-jerk reaction to do you think assisted suicide should be legalized in the UK, the answer might be yes. But of course, you then have to remember that opinion polls are somewhat manipulated. And then you come back to the idea, but it's not, you know, assisted suicide is never going to be sent out for a referendum, because we know what happened with Brexit. So it's always going to have to be brought back to Parliament. And it's Parliament, and it's the historical values that Parliament uphold, which is the reasons why they won't debate it.
But the politicians might be okay with the courts forcing them to do it, like sometimes happens in Canada, the United States, the court says this law is illegal, and then, like in Canada, the reason abortion is legal in Canada is because the only law about abortion was overthrown, and it was pretty clear that it was impossible to write a law about abortion in Canada. So abortion in Canada is neither legal nor illegal. There's no law, and there's not allowed to be a law. So the politicians are quite happy with that because they really didn't want to make the decision.
Exactly.
And this same here, but what's happening in England is that the courts are throwing it to Parliament and saying, Parliament, you have to decide, and we know where that's going to go.
That's it. Yeah, it's that simple. And that's not going to change, I don't think, in any of our lifetimes.
Yes, but it's kind of like the Irish abortion situation. People who are well enough and wealthy enough can go to Switzerland, or maybe in the future other countries will accept foreigners.
Okay, so you now bring up the very important matter of money.
Yes.
You know, it's 10 grand.
Yes, and plus travel costs, which, you know, you might be able to travel, but you might have to travel in a more expensive way. You might not be able to take an airplane, for example, so you might have to drive, take the ferry, and so there'll be additional costs that would occur.
And also, let's face it, David, I mean, if it's going to be your last journey on Earth, who the hell would want to travel EasyJet?
Yes. I've never traveled EasyJet, but I've... what about Ryanair?
I mean, seriously, I would just get online and get the barbiturates from Mexico.
Yes. Okay, yes. Well, some comments about economy, tourism. But seriously, just take the 10,000. You know, a lot of people, you know, a pensioner, poor, without too many family around, isn't going to be able to raise the 10,000.
It's true, precisely. Exactly.
And so it's a very unfair system. Like, just the same with abortion in Ireland. If you're middle class and, you know, you're not too far along in your pregnancy, you just get on a plane, go to England, and it's over with. But if you're poor, or, you know, for whatever reason you wait too long, you can't do that.
If they can afford, they can afford. Yeah, and they can go.
Yes, people who can afford. So there's like one law for the rich, or the upper middle class anyway, and one law for the poor. You know, similarly with the access to social services, like some people have an extended family and there's wealth in the family, and so if grandpa needs a special wheelchair or needs to be moved to an apartment where he can get in or out with his mobility issues, that can be arranged. But if you're completely dependent on social services, you have to beg for these things. And the wave of austerity that has gripped Europe the past many years, it doesn't make social services very generous. Even if the people within social services want to be generous, they don't have the funding.
Indeed. And here's the reason why, bringing it back, essentially bringing it back to the focus of the film, which is OMID. OMID's legal challenge is costing well over £100,000. And yet, you know, that £10,000 could be raised, and the £15,000 it might cost to hire a private jet to get OMID over to Switzerland, in the vain hope that he was able to actually do the intravenous himself, makes his struggle, I personally think, even more admirable, because he is deliberately not going to Switzerland to all intent and purpose, and they're trying to raise 6-7 times the amount of money that it would cost him to have a dignified death by keeping his legal challenge alive.
Right, and it's almost certain that it will fail, given what you've said.
Yes.
So it's admirable, because he's trying to make a point, knowing that he probably won't succeed, and he's going to draw out his agony until things draw to a natural close.
Yes.
We're coming to the end of our time, and I watched a pre-version of this film. So when will people be able to see this, and how will they be able to see this?
Well, I've had some interesting news this afternoon, which I'm not going to speak about right now, because it hasn't actually happened. In fact, Ollie doesn't even know about this.
I like scoops, you know. People get invited back when they give me scoops.
but you're a hack journalist, David. I can't give you my body and soul all in one go.
Okay, well, when you can make it public, make sure you tell me. Make sure I'm one of the first people to know.
I will. Of course, they will. But in answer to your question, we had a very successful crowdfunding campaign this month, and we've raised enough money now to get the film into a decent sound mix and a color grade, and we're going to cut it down a little bit. So by the new year, we'll have enough money to get it out onto the festival circuit. And I think the festival circuit is really the place that it needs to be, because we all have opinions. We all have, you know, arguments for and against this. And it's not for a filmmaker or a filmmaking team to persuade people. It's not even for the participants to persuade. It's for the audience to make up their own mind. So hopefully we can get it out on the International Film Festival circuit, and the film will speak for itself. And at that point, we'll see.
I at times I wanted the film to tell me what to think. You know, like, come on, you've got to have a position on this. But I mean, you showed it from different perspectives, and you know, most of the time I sympathized with the people who wanted to end their lives, but not always. And I think that helps illustrate the complexity of this issue. So I'd just like to thank you for making a truly thought-provoking documentary, more than most things I've seen recently, by far.
Well, thanks, David. We both really appreciate your time with this, and also for your comments and opinions having watched the film, because it's so important. And really, we do hope now that we can get it out there and people can make their own decisions, and they can create their own discussions about it.
Yes, and you're quite right that at a film festival, you should be able to have that discussion. And I personally think we need to go into this slowly. Like in Canada, kind of took a big step, but they didn't say everything's on the table for assisted dying.
Absolutely.
It's going to take a long time before people get the right balance, but I think, like, abortion and gay marriage, these are things that are going to happen, but, you know, in the UK, it may be maybe decades before it's actually legal there, whereas so many other countries, it will have been legal for, or at least decriminalized for many years.
And time will tell. But the point is, I think the UK is becoming known as behind the times on this, and the film and the debate and the campaigns, of which we as filmmakers are not aligned in any way. We're trying to make an unbalanced viewpoint for
a balanced viewpoint, not an unbalanced viewpoint.
Yes, but I think it's only a matter of time until a decision will be made.
Yes.
Whatever that might be, and no one knows the length of time, but somebody will make a decision, and at that point, and I think it's probably inevitable, because I think, you know, everything goes with a wave, but it could take a long time. But just to open the debate, get people discussing it, because the bottom line is no one likes talking about death.
Yes. Yes. I mean, it is just controversial, and you can come up with straw men on one side or the other as much as you want. Yep. But somebody has to make kind of a pragmatic decision, and I think that will be, it's allowed under certain restricted conditions, and that's not going to satisfy everybody, and over time it will be expanded. But on the other hand, if you just say, okay, well, if you want to end your life, you just call in a doctor and the doctor injects you, that could result with people with depression killing themselves instead of, you know, trying to...
Absolutely. And it works in, you know, in exactly the same way that, you know, if Ollie and I wouldn't, even if you, you know, ate too much over Christmas and, you know, you couldn't shed those few extra pounds at the end of January and said, oh man, I'm really depressed. Can I kill myself? It's highly regulated.
Right.
You know, it's not as if, you know, it's going to go willy-nilly and people are just going to get prescriptions for barbiturates and, you know, free airline tickets, and Ryanair are going to offer vouchers. It's a very, very regulated process.
Yes. Yeah. Which it needs to be. Anyway, we have run out of time, so I'd just like to thank you for joining me today, and I'll look forward to further news when it's finally out on the festival circuit or in other ways is accessible for viewing.
Well, really appreciate the time, David, and thank you so much.
Thank you very much, David.
Okay, goodbye, guys. Thank you for listening to episode 167 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram @infectiousmyth. Commit to monthly donations of any amount at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. Until next week, thank you and goodbye.